Hello friends. I guess many of you wondered, why does Ukraine continue to resist? Is it really worth it? So many deaths. For what? Russians cannot be that bad. Well, today I want to share with you a conversation with my father. He's a retired teacher. He currently lives in a village where I'm from. He spends his days by taking care of a mid-sized bee farm, and generally he talks to his neighbors and other villagers. So our conversation will be about the events which took place in an ordinary village in the Kyiv region in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. Basically, we want to recreate the events which happened to us the last time the Russians occupied Ukraine in 1920s. Hello, Father. How are you doing?
Hello, everyone. Currently, I am in the countryside. Everything is fine. I heat the stove with firewood and I use no gas. We hope only for victory, and I wish everyone to survive and be well in this difficult situation. Ukraine will win.
Thank you for coming back to us. It's already your second podcast on this channel. I hope our listeners will be interested in hearing your story. Well, actually, this is not your personal experience, but still you had the opportunity to talk to people who lived through these tragic pages of our history. And I think that there is a certain documentary interest in recording such indirect memories of people who lived through it. You understand well what the mood was in the country in the 1960s, 1970s, how people remembered the events of 1930s and 1940s. So the purpose of our conversation today is to try to recreate how these events were perceived by the society during your childhood. And to begin with, let's talk about the object of our conversation, namely our village called Kozhenka in Pasti region. So tell us, where do you live and why this village might be interesting to our listeners?
Currently, Kozhenka is the center of a territorial community, a township with almost 9,000 residents. The village is interesting because historically it also included other smaller villages. It was in fact a small town. It had its own infrastructure, its own crafts. There was a sugar factory, sawmills, a dairy, grain procurement with warehouses. There were several water mills, several choppers that were driven mechanically, and you could chop hay and grass for cattle. All this was owned by wealthy farmers. Then, there were workshops with forges, where you could forge and repair carts. Then, there were workshops for sewing, repairing shoes, and sewing clothes.
And what period are you talking about?
The period starting from pre-revolutionary times, the beginning of the 20th century and ending with the beginning of the 30s. Before the period of collectivization, Kozhenka was a small town with its own infrastructure and craft.
All right, we've outlined the state of the village before the 1930s, and now we will talk in more details about the period after the NEP.
Footnote: the NEP, the new economic policy, was an economic policy of the Soviet Union proposed by Vladimir Lenin in 1921 as a temporary expedient. Lenin characterized the NEP in 1922 as an economic system that would include a free market and capitalism, both subject to state control, while socialized state enterprises would operate on a profit basis. Joseph Stalin abandoned the NEP in 1928 with the Great Break in favor of the acceleration of collectivization and industrialization.
Let's start the conversation how collectivization began.
From the words of witnesses, from the words of neighbors, relatives, acquaintances, the period of the 20s and 30s, the period of collectivization, it was a very difficult, tumultuous period. Especially for the ordinary people, peasants, workers. In our village, both in the sugar factory and in agriculture, in collective farms and state farms, many families were uprooted during collectivization. Families who were landowners, people who had all the means for production, were subjected to dekulakization. That is to say, capable people suffered the most.
Footnote: Dekulakization was the Soviet campaign of political repressions, including arrests, deportations, or executions of millions of prosperous peasants and their families. Redistribution of farmland was most active in the 1929-1932 period of the first five-year plan. To facilitate the expropriations of farmland, the Soviet government announced the liquidation of the kulaks as a class on December 27, 1929, portraying kulaks as class enemies of the Soviet Union. More than 1.8 million peasants were deported in 1930-1931. The campaign had the stated purpose of fighting counter-revolution and of building socialism in the countryside. This policy, carried out simultaneously with collectivization in the Soviet Union, effectively brought all agriculture and all the laborers in the Soviet Union under state control. Kulaks were imaginary enemies. Vladimir Lenin described them as bloodsuckers, vampires, plunderers of the people and profiteers, who fatten themselves during famines. Declaring revolution against them to liberate the poor peasants and middle peasants from their counter-revolutionary collaboration with foreign capitalism.
What did this mean in practice? What happened to these people?
In practice, everything possible was taken from these people. All property, livestock, absolutely everything. Quite simply, their families were driven out into the street. And the older generation was generally sent to the Solovetsky Islands, from where they would not return. That is, they were evicted from the village, chased away. For example, the Levishchenko family suffered a lot. These people, their grandfather and their father, had many acres of land, hundreds of acres of land, and cultivated it properly. They lived well and behaved well. Well, let's say, they had done all kinds of good things for the village. But when the Soviet authorities came, they took everything they could from these people. And so their family was sent to the Solovetsky Islands. Grandfather Andrei and his wife did not return from there.
Footnote: The Solovki special camp was set up in 1923 on the Solovetsky Islands in the White Sea as a remote and inaccessible place 2,000 kilometers northeast of Ukraine. Primarily intended for socialist opponents of Bolshevik regime, Alexander Solzhenitsyn called Solovki the mother of the gulag.
Do you know if it was reported by someone from the locals? Or was it an instruction which came from the above?
There were such people among the locals. For example, even in the 70s I still knew those people who took part in collectivization. The residents of our village treated them with disrespect. Those were the people who sent their fellow villagers to death with their own hands, kicking them out of their homes. Everything was thought out by the communist regime so that different brigades worked in each village. That is, Bolshevik activists did not work in their villages. For example, we had a brigade, called the Olenivka Brigade. Behind Fastiv, there is a village of Olenivka. And the Olenivka activists took all the belongings from our people. They took away food, grain.
And how were these families determined? I mean, collectivization, it's clear that everyone had to join the collective farm. But at the same time, certain families were defined as kulaks and they were repressed.
It reached me even in the 70s and 80s, they were called proletarians. These were people who did not have their own family farm. Contrary to the rest of the village, their lifestyle was not centered around hard work. Thus they were poor, naked and barefoot, figuratively speaking. But they worked well for the Bolsheviks. So, the Bolsheviks relied on the poorest people. They recruited the poorest in the village and used them for their evil deeds.
This is a very important detail. So we should understand that the ideology came to our land from Moscow. It was a toxic Russian ideology. I mean, the revolution took place in Petrograd. Lenin was Russian and the center of the entire empire was in Russia. All important decisions that led to the extermination of Ukrainians were made over there. And all of this was made in the benefit of the empire. But here, this was the first time we mentioned that the executioners in the field, the ones who carried out those orders, often were local people. And you well noted that the Bolsheviks relied on the marginalized elements of the Ukrainian society. By the way, parallels can be drawn here to the events of 2014, when in the southeast of Ukraine, Russia relied on criminality and unemployed people during seizure of those regions. Times are new, but the methods remained old. What period are we talking about? This is the late 20s, right? We have not reached the Holodomor yet.
Yes, it was right at the end of the NEP period. It began at the end of the 20s. Collectivization led to the famine. The fact is that they took everything that could be taken. Everything that could be transported out of the village. That is, they did not leave any belongings. They did not leave any hope for life and people. They took everything, from clothes to grain, food, livestock, all the possessions that people had.
And they were taken somewhere outside the village, or where exactly?
They were taken outside the village. My mother remembered how they were taken on a sleigh. 8 families were taken through the village on sledges pulled by horses, and taken to the district center. People cried. Some gave them anything what could be given. In addition, of course, the security was carried out by the Red Guards who guarded them closely. They took them away as if they were some kind of criminals. The way the criminals are taken away.
Yes, we talked about the first 5-year plan. In fact, this first 5-year plan begins in 1928 and culminates with a famine in 1932-1933.
Footnote. The first 5-year plan was a list of economic goals. Stalin's version of the 5-year plan was implemented between 1928 and 1932.
Let's talk more about the winter of 1932-1933. This was a terrible page of Ukrainian history. How did people survive in Koshenka?
These were difficult conditions. People survived as they could. If we take our family, then our grandfather had a cousin Nestor, in Trilisky Distillery. Nestor told him to quit the sugar factory. Leave the house, take the family, and I'll make you a stoker here, he said. And he made him a stoker. And so my father and his little sister were there. They went to school there and received rations at the distillery. And grandfather also managed to bring the leftover brew of the ethanol production home. It is called Braha, with leftover bread. Because alcohol was produced from bread, from grain, and people filtered this brew and collected the thick fraction, and ate it, and thus remained alive. Somehow they managed to find some food somewhere. There were the potatoes not all dug up in the fields, but part of them was already frozen. Now and then people went to the fields to collect these frozen potatoes, and thus survived.
Footnote. The Holodomor was a man-made famine in Soviet Ukraine from 1932 to 1933 that killed millions of Ukrainians. While scholars are in consensus that the cause of the famine was man-made, whether the Holodomor constitutes a genocide remains in dispute. Some historians conclude that the famine was deliberately engineered by Joseph Stalin to eliminate a Ukrainian independence movement. Others suggest that the famine was primarily the consequence of rapid Soviet industrialization and collectivization of agriculture. A middle position is that the initial causes of the famine were an unintentional byproduct of the process of collectivization, but once it set in, starvation was selectively weaponized and the famine was instrumentalized and amplified against Ukrainians to punish them for their rejection of the new serfdom and to break their nationalism. In any case, it was a result of sick ideas born in Russia and brought to Ukraine from the outside. Period. 10% of Ukraine's population, between 3 and 5 million, perished. The Holodomor has been recognized by 34 UN member states, the European Parliament, and 35 of the 50 states of the United States as a genocide against the Ukrainian people.
Did the river help? We have a big river behind the dam.
Yes, in the spring, summer, autumn period, the rivers saved a lot of people. There were turtles, bivalve mollusks, and people caught them, boiled them, and thus consumed them. Some fished. But they say that the river was so overfished and poor that it was impossible to catch fish in the river for years after that. Because people caught everything even at night. and the Red Guards drove around, there was special security at the distillery. At the sugar factory, there was security guarding the carriages of beets. Potatoes and grain tanks with grain brew were guarded so that people would not take this brew. Well, in a nutshell, many people were shot and killed for this. But it still depended on which brigade of Red Army Guards was on duty. There are such memories. My grandfather told me that there was one brigade where they allowed people to collect brews so that people could survive. There were some, shall we say, humane individuals among these Red Army men. They somehow helped people, or at least gave them a chance to survive.
I also heard such statistics about the famine that there were no cattle or horses left at all, and this was one of the incentives for mechanization. In the Ukrainian villages, there was simply no one and nothing to cultivate the fields in the following years, and they were forced to bring some tractors there because there were no horses left at all.
Yes, there were almost no animals left because there was nothing to feed them. From the collective farms, they took all the grain, and those animals that remained were eaten. Even those animals that died of hunger, people near the disposal pits took their corpses, especially in winter, frozen corpses of dead animals, and boiled them. They survived this way. Regarding mechanization, well, it was very difficult. At that time, we almost didn't have tractors. There were some imported from the United States. This was already when collectivization and the NEP period began. Then these were US-made Fersen tractor and a CHTZ, which was a very primitive tractor, with iron wheels without rubber. That is, it was also very, very problematic with the equipment.
What did you hear about the events in the second half of the 30s? How did the attitude towards the Soviet government change after the Holodomor?
The Holodomor led to the fact that people clearly saw the reality of the Soviet rule. They saw what the Bolsheviks really were. They saw the horrors that the Bolsheviks brought to Ukraine. And people had no confidence in the Bolshevik party. People hated this Bolshevik government. Between the Holodomor and the Second World War, people had a desire to change this system. They hoped that someone would drive these Bolsheviks out. People were very dissatisfied with the authorities in the village and were waiting for some changes. Since the collectivization took place, all the active people, the landowners, were taken away and the intelligentsia was simply destroyed. People did not believe in the Soviet government. They did not want this government. They wanted these Bolsheviks to be gone, no longer in the village or anywhere else.
Well, but how did it manifest itself? Where do you draw such conclusions from?
Because it was told by people who lived at that time.
I mean, did they simply tell their attitude or tell about specific events?
They also talked about how the repressions began. When they started in 1937, we had an engineer here. He was Austrian. He had his family here, and in 1937 he was simply repressed just because he was Austrian. He was taken in the middle of the night, and no one saw him again. This person was a specialist mechanic who repaired tractors, steam harvesters, and combines. He was a valuable specialist. His children were left without a father, just because he was Austrian. So many other people were taken away by the Soviet authorities. Such repressions existed almost until the start of the war with Germany.
Okay, we are in 1941. The Germans are coming. First, how did the mobilization go? And then tell us about the departure of the Soviets and the arrival of the Germans in the village.
At first, only older people were taken to the Red Army, and then later they began to take younger people, too. For example, my father was born in 1922. He didn't go to war in the first days of the war, but got there only in 1943. Thus, he was under occupation. Some of his peers were also in the occupation. In the period when they were under occupation, some people began to be sent to Germany as Osterbeeters.
Footnote: Osterarbeiter, German term for Eastern worker, was a Nazi German designation for foreign slave workers gathered from occupied Central and Eastern Europe to perform forced labor in Germany during World War II.
Was there also a mobilization of property, livestock, cars, and industrial facilities? Do you know if any of our factories was taken away when the Soviets retreated?
Nothing was taken from our factory because we were occupied very quickly. The war was caught off guard and our troops withdrew, while the Germans quickly entered and continued to advance.
But I think there was a mobilization of horses at least, right?
Yes, horses were taken from the village for the war effort. Horses, carts, and some people with these animals were sent to the defenses of Kiev. Some of these people did not return, because there were already raids by German aircraft and German aviation bombed all the convoys going to Kiev.
Footnote: 6,850,000 Ukrainians died in World War II, or 16.3% of 1940 population. Among them were 1,650,000 military personnel and the rest, 5,200,000 people, were civilians.
Okay, so the Soviet army retreated, then the Germans entered the village.
From the words of my parents, from the words of my grandfathers, and the words of acquaintances and neighbors, the village welcomed the German troops with bread and salt. The Germans left their representative in the village. They say that he was in the rank of major at that time, a tall man. He was a good manager, and he started to manage the village. Then they created a police department, and people joined the police either voluntarily, or on the condition that if you don't go to serve in the police, they would be sent to Germany as Osterarbeiters. These were the two categories. The most able-bodied boys and girls were sent to Germany, the young and healthy. But the village sent them. I mean, there were people in the village who cooperated with the German authorities and gave them information about people to be sent.
I see. You just said that, in principle, the arrival of the Germans was perceived positively, because they were seen as a force that could supplant the Soviet government. Did the attitude towards the Germans change after people began to be sent to the West?
People hoped at first that the Germans would be able to fix life in Ukraine and, for example, in our village, restore order, stop repression, stop torturing people, and that people could live the way they lived before the Bolshevik Revolution. And when the Osterarbeiters began to be sent. But then there began to appear rumors that the Germans were mistreating the captured military personnel, that they were organizing concentration camps, and so on. So then it is clear that the attitude towards the occupation troops changed and people began to mistrust them. They saw that nothing good could be expected from this German conqueror either. And then the first partisan units began to form. Some began to flee from the village to the forests, and some began to look for ways to cross the front line and go to fight on the side of the Soviet government against Germany.
This is exactly what our grandfather did in 1943.
Yes, our grandfather crossed the front line near Bashteki in 1943 during the Korsun-Shevchenko battle. It was about 60 or 70 kilometers south of Bila Tserkva.
And there is another question. So our village is quite rich in terms of different religious denominations. We have Orthodox, we have many Protestants, we used to have many Jews as well. So tell us about the attitude of Germans towards different religious denominations in our village.
Before the war, the church was closed. It did not function. A storehouse was organized in the church, where grain was winnowed and stored. When the Germans came, they restored the service completely, and the church started working. Protestants, Baptist Christians, who were persecuted by the Soviets, also resumed services. Baptist Christians were very persecuted by the Soviet authorities. Many of them have served prison terms. The Germans restored their religion. And the Germans restored justice to those people who suffered from repression. Grand Mahala, for example, had her house returned to her family, which was taken by the Soviets, and in which there was an elementary school. The Germans gave her and her siblings their house back. There was, let's say, relief in this matter for people of faith. It was such a great gift to them.
And what about the Jewish people?
It was very difficult for them. The Jews in our village were generally skilled professionals in their field. Among them were teachers, engineers, medical workers, and doctors. Jews suffered the most in our village.
Do you know how many Jewish families were killed or expelled from the village?
According to Zinovy Ivanovich Maslow, who researched this topic because his classmate died there too. And according to my mother, her classmate Fania also died with her father. So, 39 people from our village were shot by the Nazi police.
All killed at the same spot?
Yes, behind the stadium, across the road, they were all shot there.
These people, how were they identified? Was there a synagogue in our village?
There was no synagogue in the village. They were killed just because they were Jewish by origin.
Just according to their documents?
Yes.
The Soviet authorities indicated the ethnic origin of a person in his or her passport.
Yes. There were also small children among them.
These were the horrors of the Holocaust. Children were also killed there. This was abominable cruelty. Tell us more about the relationship with the Jewish population in the village before the Holocaust. Did you hear about any segregation or discrimination before the Germans came? Have you ever heard of any negative attitude towards them? Any anti-Semitism within the village?
These people were normally integrated and lived normally as part of the community. There was no oppression of the Jews by the local population. It was the friendliest relationship. Children were playing together, went to school together, and men were working together. They mostly occupied creative positions, where they had to take responsibility. They were responsible and intelligent people, and there was no discrimination against them. They enjoyed great respect in the village. It was a tragedy for the village, which the Germans brought, and they were helped in this by the locals, who carried out the German instruction.
And let's return to the pre-war period for a bit. You can often hear stereotypes that they lived in their communities, in their ghettos. But my understanding is that there were mixed marriages and that it was normal for people to coexist and work together in the same town. Have you heard about mixed marriages between the Christian and the Jewish population in our village?
Yes, these were not isolated cases. It was not considered abnormal. Everything was very good between these people in mixed marriages.
Returning to the issue of collaborationism, we in Ukraine understand this well, but people in the West are very often surprised by double collaborationism. Even the historian Timothy Snyder had to write an entire article explaining such a phenomenon. The thing is, people in the West, for some reason, think that collaborationists were very ideological, while Snyder wrote that in the Soviet Union, the people who first collaborated with the Bolsheviks were often the same ones who collaborated with the fascists later. And an average Western European or American cannot understand it, because it seems to them that communists were left-wing and the fascists are right-wing, and in principle, they don't know that it's pretty much the same thing. And they think, how could the same people show such behavior? So were there such examples in our village when people who served the leftist Soviet government later served the Nazis?
Yes, there was. In our village, Zinovy Ivanovich talked about it. One of the managers at the sugar factory became one of the Nazi police chiefs. By the way, he was a member of the Communist Party of the USSR and worked for the German side.
The war swept across Ukraine in two waves. First, the Germans advanced, then the Germans retreated, and both waves were devastating. Did you hear which of the waves was worse for our village? Was it when the Soviet troops retreated or when the Soviet troops advanced?
The first wave was much scarier for our village. It caused great damage to agriculture and destroyed entire fields. Tens or even hundreds of hectares of grain. When the Soviet troops were retreating, they burned everything they could. Not thinking about the fact that the village remained without grain, without anything to eat. They tried to destroy anything they could. The Germans did not burn the fields when they retreated.
The years 1945, 46, 47 are the post-war devastation. I even remember my grandmother talking about the post-war famine. It was a terrible period. Plus, Stalin didn't want any Marshall Plan. It means that there was no external help. The country was broken, and there were millions of soldiers returning to their cities and villages, and they had nothing. And then a terrible famine begins. Tell us about what you heard about this post-war famine.
In 1947, there was a famine in our village. That year was just as difficult as the years 32 to 33. However, people who knew Western Ukraine a little bit traveled there, attached themselves to cargo trains, and went to ask people for handouts. Or exchange some belongings, clothes, or anything that someone had of value in exchange for bread. It didn't escape our family either. My grandfather traveled to Western Ukraine and brought grain and baked bread from the harvest, and that's how they survived the year 1947.
I think we have covered the 20 years that I wanted to talk about well. Perhaps you would like to add something to the conclusion.
Those 20 years were difficult. The people who survived were already old when I talked to them. But they said that life was much better before the Bolshevik Revolution than after the revolution.
Footnote: before the Bolshevik Revolution, Ukraine, similarly to Poland, was split between two empires, Russian and Austro-Hungarian empires. When Russia lost the World War I and signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk on March 3, 1918, Russia renounced all territorial claims in Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, most of Belarus, and Ukraine. Russia also lost Poland, but Kingdom of Poland was not mentioned in the treaty, as the Germans refused to recognize it. However, when the Central Powers lost the war and signed the Treaty of Versailles, the US, Britain and France decided to punish Germany. They recognized Poland, but existence of a Ukrainian state was considered too beneficial to Germany. Seizing the opportunity, Russia, as always, disrespected its international treaties and invaded Ukraine three times between 1917 and 1922. Without the international support, Ukraine lost its independence war against Russia and was eventually incorporated in the USSR in 1922 as Ukrainian Soviet Socialistic Republic, and all the horrors discussed in this conversation occurred as the result of it. Then Russia tried to reclaim all the other lost territories, but ran out of steam and negotiated a peace deal with Poland. Russia used this peace deal to industrialize and rebuild its army. Eventually, it invaded all the aforementioned countries in late 1930s. It conquered all of them with the exception of Finland. With all due respect to the brave Finnish soldiers whom I deeply admire, the only thing that prevented the elimination of the Finnish statehood was the threat made by the United Kingdom and France to send troops to assist Finland against the Soviet Union during the Winter War, which started on November 30, 1939. Never trust Russia.
Thank you for this information, and I hope our listeners will also find something interesting for themselves, and we will hear from each other in the future and talk about new topics. Thank you again. Goodbye to everyone.
Goodbye.
Dear friends, currently, both US and EU aid to Ukraine is blocked due to internal political reasons within these unions. Nevertheless, Ukraine continues to fight for its survival. Rest assured, it will persevere no matter the challenges. Your contribution can alleviate the hardships of this ongoing struggle. Please, continue to donate. The links to trusted charities are in the description.